Yeah. You still here?
I'm still here. I don't even know if I'm on the camera.
Let's hope okay. not. It looked like the odd couple.
Yeah, right. This is the Big Bang. Well, good morning, everyone, out there and wherever land.
TV land.
I'm speaking with Dave Lyme, who was a scientist with the North Central Research Station in St. Paul and later worked on the University of Minnesota faculty and who had done a lot of the early wilderness and wilderness-related research. So, Dave, it's good to have you here.
I'm good to be here.
Yeah, right. And speak up.
What?
Yes, right.
Speak right up.
Okay. So, Dave, what we're particularly interested in are your early experiences that contributed to your interest in wilderness and wilderness-related research. And more specifically, how did you get started with Forest Service research and in wilderness?
I suspect most of my interest early was that I liked the outdoors. I grew up in Ohio and spent some time in the islands of Western Lake Erie and kind of liked the solitude of going to places where there weren't many people around and liked to fish and had the opportunity to go to Minnesota a couple times as a kid. And when I was looking for a dissertation topic at the University of Pittsburgh, for a variety of reasons, I sort of gravitated towards outdoor recreation and natural resources because I had majored in geology for a while and then switched to geography. So how people related to landscapes and what turned them on and what they liked and disliked, I suppose, was contributed. And I had parents that didn't care much about the outdoors, and when I got interested in it, maybe that was my escape. But I'd read a couple articles by Marion Clausen, who many people probably don't know who he was, but he was an economist that wrote a couple really interesting papers. One of them was called The Crisis in Outdoor Recreation, which might have appeared in the Journal of Forestry. I don't know where it appeared, but at any rate, this was around 1964, 63, 65. And there was such a boom in outdoor recreation, he had described that phenomenon and then talked about the problems that went with it. And since trying to do a dissertation or graduate work, from what I'd learned was to be problem-solving oriented, I sort of thought, now there's a pretty neat topic because that combines people with geography and landscapes. And so I read anything I could get a hold of his.
He was one of the few people that were writing about this kind of stuff.
There weren't very many people, and references to who was doing this kind of work was basically unknown to me. But he wrote a book, and I can't think of the name of it. It was a paperback book, and it wasn't very big. And I must have read that thing four or five times and thinking about doing some kind of a project on outdoor recreation. And that really was when I was doing my master's paper. And I looked at recreational use of Corps of Engineered reservoirs in western Pennsylvania and northeastern Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I found out such things as the agencies had no idea how many people used their facilities and resources. Mm-hmm. They had any idea. They just almost made up numbers. And that seemed kind of weird that if there's all this demand and interest in visitor use of places and they have no idea how they're used and by whom and how many, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. At any rate, to make a long story short, I met a guy. I went to a National Association of American Geographers conference in St. Louis and had known about a guy who was at Ohio State named Carlton Van Doren, who had done maybe his PhD work in recreation. I don't remember the topic, but I remember meeting him, and he through a friend got us together, and I learned about what Forest Service research was, a little bit of it, and I found out there was a guy by the name of Bob Lucas who was at that conference, a geographer from the Twin Cities, in charge of a research program into wildland use of public lands, and I met Bob, and Bob and I hit it off, and within a few weeks I had an offer for a job to go to Minnesota.
And Dave, this was in what period of time, the mid-1960s?
Yeah, it would have been 66.
66,
1966. Okay. That was a couple of years after the passage of the Wilderness Act. I had no idea what that was. And there really wasn't very much literature. And at the University of Pittsburgh, there wasn't a forestry program that I remember, and there was nobody in that department that was really into the topic of natural resources issues like wilderness research or wilderness would have been under. There was a fellow that was my advisor who was into water issues and water problems, so he understood the Corps of Engineer stuff, and so we hit it off. But any rate, by June of 1967, I moved with our family to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and was immediately introduced to the Superior National Forest, which to me was like, I don't know, going to heaven. And I don't know where the interest connection with wilderness came in. It was just, this was pretty neat country. I learned to canoe. Found out you could actually catch fish that weren't bullheads and carp from Ohio. And I don't know, something about it just excited me. But I was also interested in getting a dissertation. And at the time I went to Minnesota, I really didn't have one in mind through the Forest Service and the research station and Bob Lucas and some other collaborators with Bob and the forestry program at the University of Minnesota, where Larry Merriam was the principal recreation professor. We decided I'd do something on the use of recreational use related to the Superior National Forest, and I'm not sure what led to what, but the topic came up about campgrounds, auto access or vehicle access campgrounds on the Superior National Forest. And the question was, after I'd seen them, why were there so many of these places that were heavily used and other ones were very lightly used in terms of occupancy rates? So sort of being trained in geography or by background, that seemed like a pretty good project, because there was a problem. It was sort of the why some places get more use than other places. And so, for lack of a better project, that became my dissertation. And in the process, I found out that a lot of the people that used those campgrounds went into the Boundary Waters canoe area, the wilderness adjacent to those campgrounds. And I was using the Boundary Waters some, and so it was sort of wildland, the idea of wilderness as a formal entity, I don't think had much influence on me. But at any rate,
it was kind of an evolution. You were a geographer interested in spatial relationships, the Superior National Forest, and then you started finding out that people that were using these campsites were actually accessing the wilderness. But the studying wilderness per se, or visitor use in wilderness, was not something that you made an explicit decision upon.
No.
At least when you're starting to work on your dissertation.
No.
Okay.
No, because it was, you know, wildland was wildland. What you called it was whatever, as far as I was concerned. Everything north of Duluth, Minnesota was wilderness for a kid from Ohio that grew up in an industrial small town in central Ohio. Maybe it brought back memories or connections to my time I'd spent alone on Lake Erie. But
at the time, sorry, Dave, your principal collaboration was with Bob Lucas. Is that right? And who was kind of your supervisor, I guess.
My work supervisor.
Right. And any other Forest Service researchers that were engaged, at least at that time?
At that time, just through the literature that I was exposed to, because I started in 1967, and I probably didn't meet any of those people until a couple of years later.
Right.
People like Al Weygar and Wilbur LePage and George Stankey was hired a year or so after I was hired, I don't think I met any of those people.
Okay.
I started to see some literature that some Forest Service people had written, principally Al Weygar and Wilbur LePage had been well thought of and had written on wildland stuff, but there were some other people that were university folks that were doing wildland wilderness kind of projects, but many or most of them had a connection with the Forest Service. I think Larry Merriam had, although he was kind of a Park Service connection person as well. But I kept referring mentally back to the stuff
Marion
Clausen had written about the whole topic of growing use of recreational areas, impacts to resources like trails and water quality, and potential impacts on wildlife habitat and whatnot, more and more people meant more and more congestion, and that was associated with traffic problems. And Bob Lucas, for example, in his research in the Boundary Waters, had shown that congestion and crowding were issues that over time, and maybe even when the Wilderness Act was passed, were going to have to be addressed. So I've got partway through my dissertation and the topic of crowding in the Boundary Waters as the most heavily used wilderness in the country was coming to the forefront. I knew it when I started. I knew it when Bob Lucas hired me, that eventually if I stayed with the Forest Service, I was going to have to get involved in some way or another with wilderness use in the Minnesota Canoe Country, and there'd be topics that I'd have to have some association with. So I wasn't finished with my dissertation when I was already talking to Forest Service people about issues related to crowding and congestion in the Boundary Waters. And a good avenue to talk about that was that shortly after the Wilderness Act was passed and Bob Lucas was at the Forest Service Experiment Station, he, to a large degree, I think, but with people from the Forest Service, established a data collection process to gather information about people that use the wilderness. So a permit system became developed where groups that went into the Boundary Waters had to document where they were from and how long they were going to be in the Boundary Waters and how many people in their group and et cetera, where they started their trip. That data needed to be analyzed. So one of the first things I got involved in was trying to expand the use of data collected from those permits to have it more helpful to managers rather than just interesting to know facts like how many people used the Boundary Waters this year and what was the average party size, and that you could really glean a whole lot more information by doing comparative analysis of different variables. So the Forest Service went from collecting about, I don't know, 6 or 7 tables on visitor use to, by the time we messed around with it for a couple different years, we were producing like 150 different tables. Like comparing party size by entry point to show that some entries in some areas of the wilderness were used much more by large groups than by small groups.
And Dave, at this time, you were really focused on what was going on in the boundary waters. Is that right? I mean, you were greatly influenced by because of the use levels and congestion and the impacts that were occurring there. You were greatly influenced by that. And so your geography was pretty much, at least in the late 60s, early 70s, limited to the boundary waters. Is that right?
It was, because there was nobody else at the station that was doing wilderness or wildland research. I was the only... No, there wasn't anybody else. I was a one person.
Because at the time, Bob Lucas had moved.
He moved to Missoula, right?
Right. Okay. And so, but then you began kind of broadening kind of the questions you asked, like the carrying capacity article you put together in 1970 or 71. You know, that was something that was influenced by the boundary waters. Work, your thinking, I assume.
It was, but it was trying to be, I guess for lack of a better word, conceptual in terms of saying,
right,
if crowding was a problem, what's a logical way to study it?
Okay.
And so what? Mm-hmm. Well, the issue was to define the problem and define what was an acceptable condition or acceptable type or level of use that could be achieved, and then gather information to find out whether you'd exceeded the negative impact, right, whether it was resource impacts on campsites, which folks in the College of Forestry, principally led by Larry Merriam, were doing, or were experiences to find solitude or enjoy a low level of use a positive thing or a negative thing. And Bob Lucas and some others earlier had at least come up with ways to gather information to show that there are norms out there of the kind of experiences people are looking for. And it's just not acceptable to say come one, come all, which some agencies seem to be promoting, that it doesn't matter how many people come, we'll figure out a way to accommodate them. And that was sort of the argument I heard from talking to managers and some academic types and some researchers, that what's the big deal? We're there to provide opportunities for the public, so it doesn't matter how many people come. And to me, that didn't seem like a very logical argument. Yeah. And so I think what people that were doing this carrying capacity stuff were trying to arrive at was a way of thinking about a potential problem that was out there and how you might define the problem and then study it.
So the I think one of the messages I'm getting, and we're going to have to take a break here for a moment, is that carrying capacity wasn't the stuff about carrying capacity you and people like Bob and George and a couple of others were writing about at the time wasn't so much about finding this magic number, but it was about a way of conceptualizing use management problems,
about thinking about the problem.
Okay.
There'll be a break now for lunch.
So I think it was running out of time. 30 seconds. So let me see, hopefully. Okay, we got plenty of time. 19 minutes.
Good luck fixing this.
Okay. And we're back from our break.
We are.
Yes. Dave, that was very good. And you know, this whole idea, way of thinking. Let me ask you, did it when you kind of gradually started moving into talking about wilderness in your work, which you did, you know, in the several papers in the 1970s, was there a realization that, oh, I'm studying wilderness and that's something unique? Or was it more just, hey, this is a problem that has to be solved? You know, there's no right answer or wrong answer to that question. But I think one of the things we're interested in is to what extent did studying about wilderness, visitor use in wilderness, to what extent that maybe that had influenced your research and your thoughts versus this is visitor use that happens to be occurring in wilderness?
I don't think I thought about it.
Okay.
Because early on, when Bob Lucas left for the Wilderness Research Unit in Missoula, I was pretty much on my own to survive or not survive, and locally with the people like you and other grad students and Larry Merriam and Tim Knopp and John Borchert in geography and folks like that. So it was obvious to me that the Superior National Forest had enough problems related to human use of wilderness that I could have done a whole career just with the boundary waters. And by 1973 or four, with a couple new people added to our research project and the topic of river use came up, it didn't seem like much of a transition to me. It was still wildland, and a lot of it was wildland, although we studied in rivers some urban river use things.
Right, yeah.
I was just overwhelmed by the fact, I think, in a way, that the people on the Superior National Forest and I, at all levels on that forest, realized they had some problems related to human use of the resource and that there were lots of problems to solve, and it was more than just I could be involved in solving, and so it was easy to come up with topics. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if I'm answering the question to what you wanted, but
let's ask it this way. I think you are, that when it came to choosing the topics that you eventually were engaged in research on, that was pretty much influenced, as I'm getting message, by the kind of interaction and dialogue you had with the managers.
That's right.
Okay, so the research then that you worked on had a very direct or direct utilitarian value, that this was a problem to be solved, and you have the skills and interest to be able to help in solving that problem, versus thinking about, well, what we need to do.
Well, I don't think those things are... I mean, if they say there's a problem to solve, you got to still think about it in the context of how we should study it and, and how we should address the problem. But the whole time I was with the Forest Service, I felt I was very, very strongly influenced by problem solving for the forest.
Okay.
And it started with thinking about the topic of carrying capacity and how to build on what other people had done before. And it just so happened that, and from my perspective, that folks like George Stankey and with Bob and others, we were thinking sort of the same way, that the problem, that topic had to be addressed by a new way of thinking about addressing these topics. So that led to LAC, Limits of Acceptable Change, which I wasn't directly involved with, but I always felt I was periphery involved with it.
And I think in some of those papers in the early 70s, you were talking about the notion of acceptability.
Yeah, what's an acceptable condition.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true, but I didn't have a cadre of folks to collaborate with, and so I was more focused back on what does the superior need answers for. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about everything from should we limit party sizes to try and reduce impacts on campsites and all the noise that comes with large groups getting together. Because when I started, I don't think there was a party size limit.
And not for a long time.
There was heavy congestion on portages and public landings and competition for campsites, and something was going to have to be done to reduce the congestion on certain routes. And so a guy by the name of George Peterson, who was a civil engineer professor at Northwestern University, spent a year with us, but that was in the mid-70s. In the late 60s, early 70s, he, as a user of the wilderness, connected with our experiment station, and George and I worked on the whole topic of traffic flow in wilderness, and if you knew how people traveled and where they camped and how long they stayed in the wilderness and all that, maybe traffic could be predicted and entry rates could be determined that would reduce travel congestion. Mm-hmm. And with very sympathetic and interested managers from the bottom to the top, that stuff was implemented. And in about 1972 to 73 or somewhere in there, a whole bunch of decisions were made based on wilderness research for the Boundary Waters Canoe Area that I think had implications service-wide. Yeah. I mean, talking about entry rate, entry quotas, party size limits, the issue of acceptability of the public to banning cans and bottles and things in the wilderness. So we had I think there was a very responsive audience, which I've always argued was critical if you're going to do applied research. If you can't get on board with the people who are the decision makers and they're not calling for it and say we can use it, I think there's been a real mistake made by an awful lot of researchers, whether it's wilderness researchers or others, that they're just moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic. They're not solving problems where the solutions can be used. They're, I don't know what they're doing.
Doing hobby research, I think.
Well, that's pretty I just felt I was lucky that I was very fortunate that as somebody who wasn't in a big collaborative group, I had such a interested and supportive set of management people that were willing and able and very interested in using research results that helped solve their problems, that it affected my publishing. I didn't publish stuff on the congestion and crowding in the Boundary Waters because I was spending most of the time meeting with them to talk about how it could be used.
Right.
So that was a mistake I made probably by some people's definitions. But if I had to make some errors, I'd sure vote for that over sitting in an office dreaming up another refereed journal article that was, that's another subject.
Right. Yeah, I have a couple more questions for you. You mentioned Bob Lucas moving out to Missoula. That was in, I think it was in 67.
Yeah, end of 67.
So what, during that, say, year or two period following that, and that was the establishment of the Wilderness Management Research Work Unit at the time it was the Rocky Mountain Research Station, lab.
Intermountain.
Intermountain, I'm sorry, yeah. Intermountain, then Rocky Mountain.
Forest and Ranger.
And that was in the laboratory on the University of Montana campus where that was located. What kind of working or collaboration did you do with Bob? And Bob had hired George Stankey, later David Cole. to work there. What kind of, I mean, were you involved in the sense of developing, or you were, it's kind of hard to say, involved in this kind of group of people looking at wilderness and visitor use issues in wilderness? Did you work with those
folks? I felt like I did, but distance is always a factor, so they collaborated more with their own, but Stanky and I wrote a couple papers mm-hmm. together, and I don't know which one of us did it, but we both did it. We put a bibliography together that was sort of for our own education, and it got, I thought, quite a bit of interest, because I think a lot of people found out there'd been an awful lot of stuff that had been written, and not necessarily in some real narrow focused discipline mm-hmm. that could be brought to bear on the topic of acceptable and managing mm-hmm. for what was defined as quality mm-hmm. resource and experiences. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think that thing would go anywhere, and we could put together a copy of it for some meeting or something that's right. almost a mimeographed document, and there was a lot of interest in that. So, no, I felt there was a lot of collaboration, and okay. certainly I felt like I used them, the folks there, as direct colleagues.
All right. Okay.
As I did with having communication with folks like Al Wagar, and Al Wagar I thought a lot of in that context. Mm-hmm. Will LePage. And mm-hmm. There weren't very many people in recreation research at that time.
There might have been actually 20 or so, but I think that was about the maximum.
In the early 70s, I don't know if there were that many.
Okay, well, they may have started. But at any rate, when I look back, this gets to your comments about working with the managers. When I look back over the history of recreation research and what were the major advances where the leaps were made, and they all seem to have one particular characteristic in common, and that's where researchers and managers collaborated on a particular problem. So the research had a problem focus, but researchers like you and the people you just mentioned seem to have a real strong managerial focus. And that's how they learned better what the problem was. And the managers learned, I think, better what the researchers had to offer. Mm-hmm. And that working together seemed to move the field much further ahead than when the researchers were sitting up in their ivory tower. I don't know what you think about that comment.
I agree.
Okay. All right. Good. Okay.
No, it did for me, because yeah. I was... Yeah. I don't know, there's in every discipline, I don't care if it's geography or rural sociology or history or whatever, there's the people that see a relationship between what they might do and how it might get used, and that's critical to them, versus others are doing it for, lack of a better word, basic knowledge or basic science, mm-hmm. and whether it gets used or not, it's not their purpose. Well, I came from the group that said, you better define the problem rather than have the solution in search of the problem.
Right.
And I think there's been, my observation and memory tells me that there was way too much of the latter that right. said, well, we have the solution, we have no idea what the problem is, but we certainly have the solution to what might be a problem. I always felt you better define the problem first and then figure out the right. kind of information and how it might be presented that'll help solve right. that problem. And if you can do that, it's a win-win deal. Because the other way around, that you're moving chairs around, and it's not, it may not benefit everybody, and you might have been a whole lot closer than you thought, but nobody ever reached it.
I think that's a lesson we really haven't learned very well in our field. I think there's too much separation of academia and managers when it comes to doing research on real-world problems. I mean, there's a good case to be made for doing basic research.
Sure there is.
But in terms of research that's going to change policy and management, that's where, you know, that collaboration, I think, is pretty essential.
Well, that problem-driven business, to me, should have been very important for a public agency, because if I'm working for the Forest Service, I should be trying to help them solve problems. If I'm working for a university, you can make all kind of arguments for what you're doing.
Right, yeah.
The fact of the matter was, in my opinion, an awful lot of the folks that ended up in the academic world were supported by or worked for or got their beginnings through Forest Service research.
That's right, I mean, that was my history, so, and many others.
And I remember when we got my project expanded and we were doing river-related research on human use of water resources, that we had a lot of outside research projects at universities, and mm-hmm. the students that were employed either by us or by the faculty in those universities now lead the field in recreation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Research world. And some of those folks were introduced on the side that said there are problems that need to be solved and let's help solve problems. And mm-hmm. some of them were just, well, we're doing science for science's sake, and if the managers can use it, big deal, or mm-hmm. I hope they can, mm-hmm. but our job is to produce refereed journal articles, which I'd rather not comment
right,
on.
Yeah,
but at any rate, I think the history of Forest Service research and before me was that those people really led the curve on the whole area of leisure and recreation research, mm-hmm. because there weren't hardly any universities, I don't think, that had outdoor recreation education and research. Some of it, I'm sure, was. I'm not saying it wasn't any good, but there wasn't very much of it. And by 1980, most of those programs that had advanced were by students that had come out of Forest Service support. Mm-hmm.
So the
appreciation for guys like Lucas and right. Wegar and LePage and some few others that started this stuff.
Right. When the Forest Service Cooperative Research was done with universities, it not only helped solve a specific problem in the short run, it also built the capacity institutionally and universities to have even more problem-solving capacity.
Yeah.
Okay. So one last question, and that is, you know, what led to you deciding not to do any more wilderness research?
I retired.
You retired. Okay. You had it. You've done your thing. Yeah.
I felt like I was involved in, quote, wilderness research my whole career. Mm-hmm. All of it. Because I never was involved in projects directly related to urban use of mm-hmm. neighborhood parks or cemeteries mm-hmm. as recreational mm-hmm. open space or mm-hmm. I mean, it was always resource-based problems. At mm-hmm. least I felt that's mm-hmm. what I was doing. Even when I went to the University of Minnesota and I worked sort of as a research project leader for the Park Service, as a non-Park Service employee, all those projects were